Oh, we're talking to the peripatetic chef, Christian Frangiatis. And I say that because he's always on to something new, which makes it exciting talking to him. And this particular new is way exciting. It's called One by Spork, and it's operating out of the old Spork restaurant, which is certainly wonderful enough. Explain us, first of all, why, Christian Frangiatis, you wanted to make a change, aside from your restless creativity, and why did you adopt this particular format, and then tell us what it is. So let's start with why did you have to, I mean, Spork was doing fine. Why did you have to change?
We had an 8-year run at Spork. Honestly, I just was a little bit restless with it and looking to kind of do something new. And I started thinking to myself, I just turned 61, and I started thinking, you know, how do I want to spend the rest of my career? And if I could spend the rest of my career, like in any situation whatsoever, what would that look like? And I started thinking about it, and I thought, okay, I think I know how I would like to spend the rest of my career. And so we decided to make a change to the format of the restaurant and reconceptualize it.
Okay, and now you're going to tell our listeners what this new format is of your restaurant called One by Spork.
Like I said, for 8 years we ran a restaurant called Spork, and it was a 53-seat restaurant with a, you know, all from scratch menu. And essentially what I wanted to do was distill all of the things that we really liked about Spork into a more singular experience. So we changed the restaurant Spork to One by Spork, and the reason it's called One by is because the idea was to create a singular dining experience, and where we, like I said, could distill everything that we liked about Spork into a singular experience. And so it's an 8-course tasting menu done around a 12-seat table. And so instead of seating 53 people, we now seat 12. And we do that. Initially, we're doing that once a night, and eventually we'll get to 2 times a night with that. And then it's one menu and one house, meaning no front of the house, back of the house, just one house. One singular menu, a singular wine and cocktail pairing, a singular non-alcoholic pairing, and basically a kind of a singular experience. And that's what we've distilled everything down to. And I think that's how I just want to spend, you know, the next couple of years anyway.
Well, yeah, I know you. I mean, how long have we known each other? A long time. This restaurant is in the same place as its predecessor, which is in an area of Pittsburgh called Garfield, right?
Yes. There's some debate as whether it's Bloomfield, Garfield, Friendship.
Yeah, I know. I get confused myself.
Kind of the crossroad of four neighborhoods.
Well, now, I mean, how many do you seat at a time?
We can seat 12.
Okay, and how many chefs are cooking at that time?
So, technically, we're the chefs and the waiters, and there's a total of about 5 of us total. And then there's a general manager and a bartender. So, about
how many people are cooking at any one time?
Like 5 of us.
See? Now, that's amazing. So, I mean, if you're a diner there, you get to watch your plate being done?
Yes. So what we did is we took out all the tables, and we created one horseshoe table that goes around. And what we do is we go from the kitchen into the horseshoe, and we serve from there, and we basically finish all the dishes and serve it right there to the customers, or to the guests. So us, the chefs, actually feed the guests.
Ha! And now, I mean, it's a fixed menu.
Correct.
You always have a lot of food on your menu. I mean, for every, even your set menus, you always have quite a lot of food.
how does it run in this?
The what?
Are you talking quantity-wise or
yes,
or
quantity.
Variety?
Quantity.
Well, I mean, we definitely have worked on that because we want people to feel satiated and happy. We don't want people to feel uncomfortable leaving the restaurant because the last thing we need is for people to spend 2.5 or 3 hours there and then walk out and their last memory of the place is how uncomfortable they are because they ate too much. So that is definitely a focus.
and what you said, you tend to eat all of it because it's so good. Now what about variety? And I have a little side issue there. What do chefs do with all these peculiar idiosyncratic diners that can't eat that?
So
that. Go ahead.
That really is kind of the one dilemma to the whole concept, to be honest with you, because at Spork, we really fed everybody. I mean, because Spork has its own garden and like a fairly extensive garden that some would even call a small farm, and it has like a fermentation program, and so we really have a lot of things on hand that we were able to accommodate diners in kind of a moment's notice if they had shellfish allergies or they're pescatarians or vegans, vegetarians, nightshade allergies, carrot allergies, everything under the sun. And we got it very consistently. We are not going to be able to accommodate the majority of all the things that I just reeled off.
Right.
At least initially.
Well, people should realize that before they go and announce any kind of peculiar. I've heard diners tell the servers that they're allergic to garlic, which I think is highly unlikely.
I mean,
so how do you handle that?
Every kind. So the way that that we're handling it right now is we just opened up the books for our first reservations 2 days ago, honestly. But what we've done is we've asked people to, if they have any kind of dietary restrictions or allergies, to let us know a week in advance by email, and then we will see if we're able to accommodate that or we're not able to. And if we're not able to, then we just aren't able to, and
yeah, I think it's a real downer for chefs, though. I mean, I've listened to people ordering; they're allergic to everything under the sun. And if I were in the kitchen as a chef, I think I'd be really discouraged and unhappy about all that.
So honestly, it's kind of a double-edged coin, right? Like, because if somebody gives you some notice, then you have the opportunity to really kind of shine and create a really great experience for somebody who maybe, hasn't had that many great experiences because of the limitations of what, whatever allergy or food restriction that they have. So it can be, and I think it was for Spork, really almost a strong point because, like I said, we accommodated everybody, everything. And I think we did a really good job with it. In this particular concept, it's not going to be possible. So, I mean, the only thing that we can do is we can just work ahead and we can either decide, okay, this is something that we can accommodate or it's something that we can't. Because, unfortunately, with this concept, it's 8 courses and it just goes one right into another. The whole thing is designed to be a singular dining experience.
Okay, and you have 8 courses, but they all kind of interrelate?
Yes. Yes, and all.
So you spring from one to the other. Do you have any examples on hand of that?
Sure. This is kind of what dinner looks like. When you come in, you come to the bar. So there's, like I said, we have 12 seats. So that could be 6 parties of 2, or it could be 2 parties of 4 and 2 parties of 2. And obviously they're going to come at slightly different times. So what we do is we open up the dining room at 5:30 and we seat at 6:00. So the people come in initially and they'll go to the bar and they get a welcome cocktail and they get basically four welcome bites, which are different things, like a hakoyaki, which is like a takoyaki, except for it. So it's like a takoyaki. And the takoyaki in Japanese is basically means pan fried, and then taco means octopus. Well, this is hatoyaki, because that's the Japanese word for squab. So it's basically a fried squab ball, with various sauces. So that's one like welcome bite. Another welcome bite is a tartlet with a mushroom duck cell and pickled onions and like a goat cheese. Then there's another one with I'm trying to think what all the welcome. Oh, there's a tuile that's got smoked cauliflower puree and pickled beets and blueberry molasses. So there's little bites like that you eat while you're at the bar waiting for everybody to arrive and get seated. Okay, then we do seven courses. Courses are everything from, I think there's a Elysian Fields lamb tartare with homemade rye crackers and crispy onions and duck fat and tamari cured egg yolk. After that, there's a sweetbread that is essentially dredged in a koji flour, and then it's done in a koji tempura with celery puree and horseradish. There's halibut that's miso glazed, and then it's served with like a Hop and John pumpkin ravioli. those are examples of the dish. There's a A5 Australian Wagyu that's brushed with a mushroom garum and seared and then served with a gorgonzola and collard green souffle that's got a little bit of caviar on the spoon that you plunge in to eat it. So it's things like that.
Well, now, do you still do everything in-house yourself? I mean, I never understood how you had time to do that. And the other part of that question is, a long time ago when we were talking about this concept, you mentioned you were going to have a way for people to see the stuff in progress, like your fermentation lab. I mean, tell us about that. Is that a changed concept? And are you doing everything in-house again?
No, we absolutely are doing everything in-house, and we do have a full food lab at this point. So one of the things that we did, historically, there's not really a lot of restaurants, at least, not in Pittsburgh for sure, that do a lot of, like, fermentation and food lab stuff.
Right.
We've done it a lot at Spork, and we kind of did it like most people do, sort of like in the basement. And then at this point, with One by Spork, we decided to move everything upstairs and out into the dining room. So in the dining room right now, we have a centrifuge. We have a roto-evaporator. We have a huge dehydrator. We have a freeze dryer. We basically have a lot of, like, really sciencey stuff. And we do all that. In view, and in fact, part of the thing is that there's also a blast freezer that gets down to like negative 40 degrees in like 5 minutes. So it's really fun, and we have all that stuff out front, in specially constructed cabinets. There's also a koji fermentation chamber made out of cedar. It's hand built by a cooperage, and then all of the ferments and stuff are displayed out in the dining room.
See, there's that other part of you that's, you're the mad scientist, too. You've been doing that for so long, experimenting with everything.
It's funny because it sounds really complicated, but in reality, I think, what we do is we sprout koji, and we make misos, and we do garums, and we do powders, and we make vinegars, and we do, black apples and black garlic and black shallots and stuff like that. But in reality, what we're actually doing is we're just putting umami in everything. And that's the purpose of all of that, is hopefully there's the umami.
And you better explain umami to, I mean, most people listening to the program know umami, but why don't you just give us a quick overview of what umami is?
Oh, wow, that's actually hard for me to articulate. But, you know, it's the thing, you know it when you taste it, right? It's I guess, what they call, like, the sixth sense, more or less, or right, because there's acid, and there's sweet, and there's salty, and there's spicy, and this is sort of like that savory sense that soy sauce, for example, is something that would give umami, black garlic, I guess a bad example of umami would be MSG, you know, but I think that, you know, the purpose is to create kind of layers of flavor.
You know, the funny thing that I've seen listed as a taste, and I don't know if it'd be number seven, is tingly. Have you seen that too?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that would be true. Yeah, I haven't thought of it that way. But it's definitely
Well, I never did
until
I started reading. I mean, I started reading it, and all these people are claiming it now, and they're putting it on labels, they're doing all kinds of stuff with tingly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's something that you definitely know when you taste it, because it's that layer of depth of flavor. And so, at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to achieve, and that's why we do all of these things, you know, is to make our own vinegars or garums or powders that you can flavor things with, lots of different kinds of misos. I mean, we'll dehydrate homemade misos that we may have made with pepitas and homemade koji, and then dehydrate that into a powder, and then put the powder into homemade chocolate, because we also have a chocolate program where we do, like, bean the bar chocolate.
Christian, I mean, sometimes I can barely follow you. Your head moves so fast.
Yeah.
You must dream about all this stuff.
Unfortunately, yeah, on occasion we have a restless night or so. Or oftentimes now, in the dream there's a burning duck that I can't get to, but yeah.
What about this, your beverage program? I mean, you've always had good beverage people on staff there. I mean,
we have a mad genius now. We have Cecil Usher, and he's like a local legend, and he's basically, honest about it, he's a mad genius.
Who is it?
We have not been Cecil Usher.
I love him. Oh, that's great. He's a genius.
He's an absolute genius. He's exactly that. He's a madman. And you know, we've only been working together now for about a month and a half, but it's incredible. I mean, he takes all the cues from the kitchen and the stuff that we're doing, and he just works off of that in really ingenious and creative ways.
Yeah, I think he's a marvel. I really do. He will have everything special, but tell us what, in general, like, what's your drink program like?
Okay, so what we've done is basically, when you come in to eat, included in your dinner is a pairing, and you basically have a choice of a full non-alcoholic beverage pairing, which would be like seven non-alcoholic beverage cocktails, or a combination of a cocktail and wine pair. And that's it. That's the whole beverage program. So, yeah, there's no a la carte beverages. So when you order dinner, you get one of the two. You get a pairing of your choice, either non-alcoholic or alcohol. And alcohol is, and everything is paired specifically to the dishes that we create. So
that's kind of unusual. I mean, I've been a lot of places where it alters between the two. Between alcoholic and non-alcoholic in one tasting menu. but you don't do that.
Well, and we do that as well. So, okay, let me rephrase that. So the alcohol tasting menu has some non-alcoholic on it, but the non-alcoholic has no alcohol, if that makes sense. Right, like so when people come in, for example, and get the welcome cocktail, that's always non-alcoholic.
Uh-huh.
You know, so if 12 people come in, they get 12 non-alcoholic cocktails initially as soon as they come in. So there will be some non-alcoholic stuff interspersed throughout the alcohol tasting pairing menu, but obviously no alcohol in the non-alcoholic. If that makes sense. So you have a choice.
Mm-hmm. So, and then you've had a couple of roll-out dinners with like friends and family and stuff. I mean, what kind of reactions are you getting?
Very, very positive. Extremely positive so far. So, the 26th will be our actual first night of business.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the 26th and the days after that go as well as the initial rollouts, then I think it'll be fine. Yeah, because
best of all, it keeps you entertained.
It does. I mean, I think the benefit to this concept, the biggest benefit, is there's really nothing that you can't. Like, you can't say, like, oh, I don't have time to do this, or I don't have a budget to do this, or you really have the time to do just about anything. You know, like, okay, like, just a quick example, there's a bread that we're doing, which is, it's a baguette, but with the baguette, we are milling our own rye flour and sifting it, and then we have a sourdough starter that we're tending to. And then in place of what would normally be water, what we did is we juiced potatoes, and then we took potato juice and put it in a centrifuge and ran it through a centrifuge and eliminated all of the starch. And then we put that in canning jars with fried potato peels that have been fried in butter, and then we run that through a pressure cooker and essentially toast it and then strain it, and then that's the water for the bread. So that's a very, very involved process. But the thing is, we're only serving 8 dishes. There's literally time to do anything. So if something will improve it, if some process will improve a dish by 10% or 15%, we have time to do that. So I think that's really where all the fun is because we're not, we don't have to worry about putting out a 15 or 20 item menu and feeding a lot of different people a lot of different things with a lot of different choices. Mm-hmm. It's the singularity of the concept that makes it most interesting for me and the most fun.
A question, how frequently do you change up the menu so our listeners would know how often they can go with something new and exciting to order?
That's an excellent question. That's an absolutely excellent question. And what we've come up with is we feel like we always have to have new dishes in the pipeline. So if we're putting out a menu today, we have to be simultaneously working on at least a single dish for tomorrow, at least a single dish for the next week. So what I think that we would most likely do, like I said, there's 8 dishes, right? And then there's a couple desserts and there's welcome bites. Some of that has to change weekly. So I would say at least, one dish has to change every week. So if you were to come, on the third week of September, by the third week of October, at least half of the menu should be different. Because if we're going to expect people to be repeat diners, we understand that we can't sell them the same experience twice.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess there are two follow questions. You've partially answered the one, how hard is it to get a reservation? The second is it going to cost an arm and a leg for this experience? Oh, and there was a third question. What was my third question? I'll think of it in a minute. If you deal with the first two.
So reservation-wise, I mean, right now it's hard to get a reservation, and I understand this, but, I mean, we just literally opened up the books, you know, 2 days ago. So, okay. And there have been a lot of people who have been waiting for us to reopen and to see what this is all about. So even I'm not that excited because it's really, you know, because reservations are coming in strong because we have to wait and see where we land. But initially, right now, it's a little hard to get a reservation. As far as price goes, we are about $260 per person.
Per person.
And we, correct. And we price it that way.
All inclusive,
still not with gratuity, though. But yeah, all inclusive in terms of alcohol pairings and food and everything, right? No matter what, it's $260.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, there's no a la carte anything. So it's just, it's $260. Which is definitely not cheap, but it's also, I think, equivalent to kind of what you would spend if you went to a good steakhouse and got a bottle of wine. I think it's roughly about that.
It's also, it's like an evening out as well as just a meal. I mean, that's, I think that's the point, right? Yeah.
Right, but I mean, the reality is that for example, we went to a couple restaurants that were similar in concept, one in West Palm Beach, one in Washington, D.C., which were at least double that. And our thinking, there are two things that were very important to us. Is one, to keep the price down enough so that it wouldn't just be like a place that somebody would come on their 25th anniversary or, you know, it's something that's it's reasonable enough that people could say, hey, let's just go out, you know, on a Saturday night and have dinner.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that was very important to us is to try to keep the time down. We want to keep it to about a 2-hour experience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that 3-hour tasting thing got so tired when, I mean, it's one thing if somebody does it like once a month or something, but when I had to do that, like, for 2 weeks in a shot, when I was doing the regular reviews, I mean, I lost it. I just couldn't cope with that.
I think guest fatigue is a huge issue in this kind of a format. I've eaten in Michelin-starred restaurants that I couldn't wait for the thing to be over, even though I enjoyed the meal.
Yeah, I know. I've been there.
and it's exactly that, you know. So it's very, very important that we keep the whole experience to about 2 hours.
Okay.
If
you move on to more than one seat in a night, then you'd be able to manage that. You can't do more than that.
Right. First and foremost in my mind is what kind of a commitment we're asking the guest to make. So what I'm saying is that the guest has a 2-hour time commitment and a $250 financial commitment. I think I understand that that's not cheap, but I think that that's doable for a lot of people. I think that that's something that they do at steakhouses frequently. I think if you go to a really good steakhouse, you spend about that much money and you spend about that much time. And so I don't think that it has to be, hey, we can only do this once a year.
And that also doesn't take into account what people pay for some of these special celebrity chef dinners in Tokyo.
That always flabbergasted me.
They're pushing $1,000, you know, it's just absolutely incredible. All right, one last issue.
We literally did just spend $1,000 in a person at a restaurant in Florida, and it was a great restaurant, you know, and it was a tasting menu type of restaurant, and small tasting counter, similar to the kind of thing that we've opened up. But we literally paid $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. So one final thing is the website. Can you spell that out for the listeners?
Sure. It's 1-O-N-E-B-Y spork spork .com.
At?
What? Oh, yeah. One by spork .com, right?
Is that it? Did it not add anything?
I don't think so. I think it was just won by Sport.com. If it is at some, well, I'm a chef, and I don't know about these things.
I'm definitely not a technological
geek.
Listeners, just remember, it's one spelled out, by spelled out, spork.
Yes, spork.
Spelled out. So,
right.
Anyhow, I wish you well on this adventure, Christian Frangiatis. And, I've done your work for many, many years, and so I'm really looking forward to experiencing this. And I'll get back to you on that, listeners. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate it. Looking forward to seeing you soon.
Yes.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.